Meet Mrs. McSugal. Her memoir bears no resemblance whatsoever to real life. It is 100% fiction and fabrication, or, to put it bluntly, complete codswallop. Indeed, none of the public figures named will recognise one grain of truth in her farcical fibs and fantasies. This satirical monologue does not represent the views or actions of any person, living or dead.
Mrs. McSugal, Scotland's second finest actress.
You couldn't make it up, but she just did. Episode 5, Waiting for a Star to Fall.
Cindy Lou Redgrave McSugal! I looked around the table for support, but everyone seemed perfectly normal. Didn't they know? Why the hell were they clapping? I remember screaming, "She's not an actress, she's a fireman's pole dancer!" But everyone appeared to think I was just getting caught up in the excitement. You should have heard the roars when Mrs. Mutton Dresser's Mutton stood up and waved to everyone while trying to look humble. Except she's not that good an actress. Then I saw him, my Morris, looking tanned and toned in a lemon tuxedo, gazing up at her with such love and pride as she bent over and kissed him. And I mean a real lingering smackaroonie on the lips. There were tongues. Then there were tonsils. It was so distasteful with Macaulay Culkin present, and before I knew it, I had shouted, "Get a room, ya whore!" I must have hit rock bottom to use such language in front of Zoe Wanamaker. But it was only when she started to wiggle her way towards the stage that I realised she had to walk right past our table to get there. Well, I don't know what came over me. But before you could shout, "Your forehead's so stretched, your eyebrows are vertical," I stuck out my slingback, said, "Oops, a double daisy," and she fell headfirst into some Bay City Roller's lap. I know, I felt terrible, I really did, but there was no damage done other than a broken stiletto, and she did find the time to take a selfie while she was down there. It went viral. But the looks I was getting from around the room, the hostility was shocking and most undeserved. I tried to apologise most sincerely as she lay there, but oh no, Miss Bung was having none of it. Whoopi had very kindly picked up all the items that had fallen out of her handbag, purse, comb, methadone, but didn't get a word of thanks as our winner grabbed them, hoisted up her dress and hobbled her way towards the stage. To give her her due, she managed to read her acceptance speech with one half of her glasses smashed, and I began to have a modicum of respect. Playing the victim seemed to be her best role to date, until she started the crocodile tears, bleating on about her devoted husband. "She means pimp," I shouted. "Morris McSugal." "I wouldn't be half the actress I am without you," she said. "You're only half an actress now," I screamed as I began to enjoy myself. But the final straw came when she started to sing, "My love is like a red, red rose." "She didn't write that," I shouted. "It was Pam Ayers." And next thing, well, I was like a woman possessed. I could hear my therapist, Dr. Jekyll's voice saying, "Feel the fear, Jeannie, but in your case, for God's sake, don't do it anyway." But I couldn't stop myself. I stood up, climbed onto the table and started to sing, "Tell me it's not true," at the top of my voice. I assumed everyone would join in, but the silence was deafening, apart from a series of protracted bottom burps from the direction of the last of the summer wine table. Still, it was nice to see that every eye in the room went from the Mrs. McSugal standing on stage to the Mrs. McSugal standing on table 62. I was having a bit of bother remembering the rest of the lyrics. That Willie Russell is too clever for his own good sometimes. But I do remember Whoopi reaching over and stuffing leftover blancmange in my gobbet to try and shut me up, and Sooty hitting me with that pathetic magic wand of his. I think it hurt him more than it hurt me, to be honest. I never did reach that rousing final chorus as Denzel suddenly appeared at our table, and he wasn't looking his usual jovial self.
It turned out he had instructed Supolod's bodyguard to remove me from the building. And next thing I know, I'm being bundled over a rather muscular shoulder and marched towards the fire exit. "Me!" I shouted. "What about her? Does she care that she's destroyed my life? Does she, Buble? That varmint stole my husband!" My words echoed round the room, and for a few seconds, I honestly believed the mood was turning in my favour. "This is it, Jeannie," I thought. "Your big moment." And I was about to break into "Don't cry for me, Argentina," when E.T., quite unnecessarily, shouted from the stage, "Your ex-husband, you fraud! The one you don't have a good word to say about!" I was stunned. Stunned at the effrontery, not to mention the betrayal. But I defy anyone to come up with a witty riposte when the angelic Hannah Gordon is stood in front of you, dressed as the world's most lovable alien. Drat, I thought, as my dream of a new career in musical theatre began to look in doubt, and I was unceremoniously carried out to the night's biggest ovation, which was at least some consolation. I waved and blew kisses to the crowd over the young man's shoulder, but once we left the auditorium, I was manhandled through the kitchens, past Emily Bishop from Corrie, who was having a fly fag in the staff smoking area, and dumped in the overflow car park next to a pair of rather surprised-looking wood pigeons. I'd have expected more manners from a bodyguard of Sue Pollard, but he just left me there, propped up against Stellan Skarsgård's Citroen dolly. For a moment, the pigeons stared at me, then stared at each other in amazement. But I couldn't handle any more awkward silences for one evening, so I told them, "Don't worry, darlings, I'm in the biz. There's no such thing as bad publicity." To this day, I'm not sure if they recognised me. "But what a hullabaloo, I hear you say. Well, let me assure you most sincerely, I am full of remorse. Of course I am. It was a criminal waste of blancmange. But in my defence, darling Hugh Grant has done much worse, and we all love him, don't we?" After all the drama, there was a bit of a hoo-ha in the press, so I attempted to change the narrative by announcing my engagement to Charles Dance and set about tracking down Morris to put the record straight. I finally found him on the Shape Up and Dance with Sheila Hancock fan site, and I sent him a message saying I had been terribly upset seeing him with Miss Faircoat and Nae Knickers. I told him I'd always thought we were Rod, Hal and Emu. Can't live with you, can't live without you, and that one day we'd be together again. He replied almost immediately and said it was certainly true he couldn't live with me. Then he finished by saying his lawyer was seeking an injunction to prevent me from contacting him or his poor wife ever again. Well, I must have read the message a dozen times as I kept thinking, there has to be a hidden meaning in these words. Is he telling me he still loves me? That he wants me back? But eventually I concluded, probably not. To add insult to injury, the following day I received an email from Denzel, thanking me for my services to the theatre, but informing me he'd removed my name from the digs list. After all I've done for that bloody place. I emailed back and begged him to reconsider, giving Ian McKellen as a character reference and reminding him that without me, he could kiss goodbye to Simon Callow's one-man show. But all I received was a three-line reply saying Ian McKellen's reference had been anything but flattering. And he didn't need Simon Callow anyway, as he'd booked Melvin Bragg to give a fascinating talk on the history of the prawn cocktail. I don't think I've ever felt so let down in my life. And how Simon Callow will feel being upstaged by a prawn, I hate to think. Denzel emailed again a few days later to tell me that he was now in receipt of even more damning evidence. Apparently, Sir Ian had bumped into Benedict Cumberbatch at the actor's laundromat, and Benedict told him some beastly nonsense about me being a kind of delusional fantasist, declaring my unrequited love to a series of well-known actors. I was lost for words. I ask you, how could anyone think such a thing? And what's all this about unrequited? I demanded evidence, thank you very much. But he said he'd need a month to talk me through it all, quoting Champion, my former agent, as saying he'd dropped me years ago as I made Walter Mitty look like a steady Eddie. I hit reply immediately and said there must be a simple misunderstanding. Champion must have meant it as a compliment, a testament to the vast range of roles in my repertoire. But I'm still awaiting the courtesy of an apology. What hurts the most is that Denzel would take Sir Ian's word against my own. Dr. Jekyll tried to help me understand the situation better. "Really, it's not so bad," he said. "It's simply your word against Ian McKellen's." "Well, not exactly," I said. "Are you telling me there are other accusations?" he said. "I don't know," I said. "Maybe a couple. It's all too painful to talk about." "But you must talk," he said. "I had this out with you in the sauna. Now, spit it out. How many accusations were there exactly?" "Oh, really, it's only Hannah, Benedict and Sir Ian," I said. "And Champion, if you count him, which I certainly don't." "Well, that's not too bad," he said. "Not everyone has to like you. We're all made differently. And Barbara," I continued, "and Moira and Maureen, with Jimmy, Brad and Angie, Whoopi, Dame Maggie, J.K. and Jane, Giles and Judy, Lord Lloyd Webber, Morris, though he doesn't really mean it, Lulu, Pierce, dear Prunella." I never did get to finish as I suddenly noticed the poor man was silently weeping, the tears rolling down his cheeks and dripping onto his bare chest. I felt dreadful. Here I was droning on about my problems when he clearly had enough of his own. "I'm so sorry," I said. "Please feel you can tell me anything. Ask anyone. I am very discreet." But the poor man just sat there unable to speak. "Is it your wife?" I gently probed. "I never did take to her. Rumour has it she was hammering away with that Leonardo from the garage while you were in hospital donating your spleen to her mother." I could tell I was helping when he started to dab his eyes gently with a tissue. "No, it's not my marriage," he said, "or at least it wasn't until now. I simply can't bear to listen to another word you say. You see, I never wanted to be a psychiatrist. I longed to be a hotel receptionist, but my parents said it wasn't a proper career. I still dream of handing out keys and telling people what time breakfast is served and..." "Why, that's beautiful," I interrupted. "Well done on sharing," thinking, "I'm buggered if I'll listen to any more of this self-indulgent bunk." "You should share more often," I told him. "Maybe you could phone and make an appointment with yourself." At this point, he became quite hysterical. "Good for you," I said. "Better out than in," as he took deep breaths into a barf bag. "I'm so glad I was able to help. Same time next week." One by one, all my so-called friends in the business cancelled their bookings. They said it was nothing personal, they just didn't want to be associated with the likes of me. My final guests, Kirsty and Phil, left on Saturday morning, and I admit to having a wee greet to myself as I waved her off in her silver Rolls-Royce with personalised number plates and him on his rusty old tandem. They were filming that nice house programme of theirs with my neighbours, Bob and Betty Baxter. They're splitting up acrimoniously. Bob and Betty, not Kirsty and Phil, heaven forbid. Everyone's talking about their terrible rows, so it's not entirely unexpected. But I'm sad for their chickens. I can't make out what they're fighting about, even when I stand on tippy-toes on their septic tank, so it should make for some good telly. The house is so quiet, I find myself thinking the same things over and over. I ask myself, why? Why Helen Mirren? I could have been her if she'd only decided to become a nurse or something more suitable. I would have made a great Helen Mirren. Still could if the woman would only buy an agar and a top-loader and retire to the Cotswolds. I'm forever sending her details of idyllic cottages in Chipping Norton. Not that I get any thanks for it. I have found myself a fabulous new acting agent called Bullet Logan, who thinks I should play the hand that's dealt. If the public think you're deranged, then specialise in playing baddies. Bullitt's currently serving time at His Majesty's pleasure for fraud and crimes against colouring books, but he assures me he has the contacts to make mine the biggest comeback since Anthea Turner. I paid the deposit on the spot and have high hopes if I could only track him down. His mobile appears to be out of order, but I'm sure he's busy planning my big comeback. I can't even phone Morris, as I'm told it would breach the terms of the restraining order. How daft is that when there is so much we need to talk about? Since Dr. Jekyll's enforced early retirement, I have been talking to my kindly old-school GP, Dr. Finlay, and he has prescribed me some super shiny antidepressants and forbidden me from listening to any James Blunt records. "Half my waiting room are here because of that bally man," he told me. Shocking, isn't it? No wonder the NHS is under such terrible strain. Dr. Finlay says he wants me to go for something called CBT. He says it will help me separate my thoughts and I must try and live in the here and now. "Are you out of your tiny mind?" I said. "That's the last thing I need. I've spent my entire life trying to avoid the here and now." Bless him, he's such a clever man, but I could have done without the lecture about mixing up reality with fantasy. "You say that as if it's a bad thing," I laughed, and thanked him for his concern, but assured him, "Don't worry about me, dear. I'm happy. Happy, I tell you." As a child, I wrote my name on this frosty window pane. I would run upstairs to my room after I'd finished my chores and gaze out at the mountains and up to the stars. The big skies gave me hope somehow that it was all out there, somewhere, waiting for me. It's a nice view, but I can't look at the mountains for long anymore. I get too claustrophobic. They're a constant reminder that I'm still here. I'd leave in a flash for the right role, but in the meantime, I must keep my creative juices flowing. People say to me, "Oh, Jeannie, you're so full of crap, you believe your own stories one of these days." And I say, "Of course I do, darling. I'm an actress. How else do I get through the day? It's when I stop believing that I panic." The nights are the worst. I lie there in the dark, willing myself to remember the bright lights, the famous faces, Hannah Banana. But my heart races and my head won't stop whirring. I feel like I'm going mad, as if none of it really happened. How ridiculous is that?
Mrs. McSugal, Scotland's second finest actress, starred Carolyn Pickles. It was written by Jonathan Fortingall. Sound by Norman Goodman. Song title is Funky Disco by Biz Baz Studio. It was directed by Colin Wakefield and produced by Yellow Brick Grove in association with Double Honours Productions. Book available on Amazon. Mrs. McSugal is dedicated to Hannah Gordon, a truly fine Scottish actress.